Well, welcome everyone. We are studying the book of Esther tonight, so open up to the book of Esther. We'll probably read from it quite a bit. I'm taking John's map that he found and prepared for you last week. I was like, oh, there's Susa. I'm using that one too for Esther. So if you have the one from last week, if not, you can just grab it up there. I'll reference it really quick, but it's just kind of helpful to see where things are going on. And because this does kind of take place around the same time, right in there with Ezra and Nehemiah. Let me pray for us again, and then we'll get started. Father, thank you so much for this evening. Thank you for all these faithful people who are wanting to come out tonight in the just the bitter cold that's out there. But I thank you for the warm fellowship that we can have in here. And I pray tonight that you would be glorified as we look at and think through the message, the themes in the book of Esther, and that we would be just encouraged, convicted where we need to be, and just as we study and look at this marvelous piece of the Word of God. In Jesus' name we pray, amen. All right, so the title, so the first little section there, the title is Esther. It is one of only two books in the Bible named after a woman, the other being Ruth. Esther is the Persian word for star, so that might be where she gets her name from. It was common for people, for the Jews in captivity in Susa to name their kids out and to give them Persian names, so it could be that. Her name also could be derived from the Babylonian god of love, Ishtar, and sounds close to Esther. That's not her name in her Hebrew name. We'll see that as we go on here, her real name or given name, but it's Esther, Queen Esther, when she becomes queen. So there is the author of the book of Esther. There's no definitive author. Jewish tradition, most tradition says it was Mordecai. Some early church fathers believed it was Ezra or Nehemiah. I personally think Mordecai makes the most sense, especially since his position by the end of the book, it just seems like it's something that it makes sense that he would author. Whoever the author is, though, most people agree that it was a Jew who had a detailed knowledge of Persia and the palace in Susa, who had a good understanding of Hebrew culture. In the end, though, it's one of those things that doesn't matter that much. But if I had to bet on it, I would say Mordecai. That would be who I'd go with. The date, so I'm going to spend a little longer on this. The events in this book, the events in this book take place sometime between 483 and 473 BC. And the book seems to have been written, shortly after the events take place. As you see in 10, it's this record of events that leads to the observance of the Purim, the Jewish feast day. And so some of the ways that we figure out the date, Ahasuerus, who is the Persian king, who is one of the main characters in this book, was assassinated in 465 BC, and Esther 10, the 10th chapter of Esther, makes it kind of sound like the book might have been written after this point. Ahasuerus is the Hebrew transliteration of the Persian name that I can't pronounce, but I'll try it. It's Khashahrashah. This is the Persian name, it's K-H-S-H. So that's where I'm messing up here. That's not a thing. You don't do that. Those are letters that don't go together. Khashahrashah is the Persian name, but he's best known for the Greek translation of his name, Xerxes. So as you're reading this book and you see Ahasuerus' name, it's Xerxes. That's who he's better known in the world. But the book was probably written before 331. That's the latest that we think that it could have been written, 331, because that's when Greece conquered Persia. And in the book, there's no kind of trace of any type of Greek influence that we see in other books from around the world that were written after that point. So it had to be written before 331. The Hebrew is not, it looks like it's got to be definitely before the second century BC. There's a particular way Hebrew looked then that this doesn't look like. It looks a lot like the book of Chronicles. And the author seems to have had an eyewitness kind of understanding of Persian culture. So that leads us to think it was probably a pretty early date, probably right after Xerxes is assassinated. So the events of this book, when we're thinking of the date, as far as the events of this book, we need to keep in mind some important dates. The Babylonian captivity has technically, at this point, the time of Esther has technically ended, as many Jews have already begun to return to Israel. 538 BC is when Ezra is when the first Babylonian captivity has technically ended. Some Jews have already begun to return to Israel in 538 BC. Ezra leads the second group of exiles returning in 458 BC. It was, and I'm just kind of recapping some of the stuff I know John probably talked about last week, the decree of Cyrus for the Jewish people to return to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. That was the beginning of that, 539 BC. Ezra 1 through 6 is about that first group returning from exile, establishing the return of the program of Judaism, the temple being rebuilt, all of that stuff. And then, so that's Ezra 1 through 6. And then 458 BC, that's the second return. That's Ezra 7 through 10. And the events of this book, the reason why I'm saying that is because the events of the book of Esther take place during the time between the first and second returns in the book of Ezra. And it chronicles the plight of the Jewish people who are left in Susa during that time. That's actually, if you look at your Bible reading plan that's supposed to be chronological that we gave you at the beginning of the year, and you get to like week probably like 46 or 44 or something towards the end, you'll see Ezra 1 through 6, and then it'll have you read Esther, and then it'll have you finish Ezra, because that's when Esther took place. So that means that chronologically, when we're thinking of the Bible, only the end of Ezra, Nehemiah, and the book of Malachi take place after Esther in the Old Testament. And that's really significant when we think about the themes of the book that we're going to talk about in a little while. So I think in your handout, I think I put date and historical background, and I gave you a little bit of room to write there, because I want to talk a little bit about the historical background, because as you can see on your document, on this big old thing, one of the major interpretive challenges of the book of Esther is that people accuse it of being a work of fiction. So if you look at like page 5 on this big old handout, one of the interpretive challenges, it's actually the main one, is that they think it's a work of fiction because they think that it contains things that couldn't possibly be true. So that's a big interpretive challenge. But there's a lot of good historical stuff in the book of Esther. There's actually an archaeological discovery of a group of Babylonian legal documents that were compiled toward the end of the 5th century. They're known as the Murashu texts, chronicling much of Babylonian history, and they show that during the time of Xerxes, there were Jews prospering in the Persian Empire. So that's some outside biblical stuff that demonstrates that. And Esther portrays Xerxes as the king, as a power-hungry egomaniac. And as more archaeological evidence comes forth and more things about the Persian Empire are discovered, history has shown him to be one who truly gloried in his power and in his rule, and he loved to display his riches and luxury. So the more stuff gets found out about Xerxes, the more the book of Esther looks, yeah, that's the guy. That sounds like him. So one of Xerxes' greatest accomplishments was the completion of his father's palace in Persepolis, That's not in the Bible. That's a archaeological find. But archaeologists found this inscription on one of the foundation stones, and roughly translated in English, it says this: "I am Xerxes, the great king, the only king, the king of all countries, which speak all kinds of languages, the king of this entire big and far-reaching earth." That's the best we can do in English. I'm sure it sounded much more majestic than that to them. "But the king of this entire big and far-reaching earth, the son of King Darius, a Persian, son of a Persian, an Aryan of Aryan descent." So you can hear that he is truly, in extra-biblical stuff, he thinks well of himself. He's got a lot of pride in him. And Xerxes, though history records him as, he wasn't as successful or as big a deal as his father, King Darius, but he did have a few major accomplishments. He reconquered Egypt. He suppressed a Babylonian rebellion. But one of the things he's most famous for is in 480 to 479 BC, we're told by ancient historians that he led a Greek expedition which ended in many embarrassing defeats. He was beaten over and over again. And that's important to know because that took place during the time, during the events of the book of Esther. That said, there are several things that people use to challenge. So there's a lot of reasons why we should see from history that Esther is historically accurate. But even with those things that I just talked about, a lot of people challenge several things in the book of Esther. And they believe it's a complete fiction or at best maybe a historical kind of novel where they take historical things and then embellish them a little bit. But some of the things that they do, so if you look at your handout, we'll just go through those. Some of the things that they have issue with are the improbable, what they believe to be improbable details, like 6 months of feasting that you see in Esther 1:4 that takes place in Persia, a year-long beauty pageant, the preparation for the beauty pageant in 2:12, the height of Haman's gallows, which are in... Now, your handout says 5:4, but it's actually 5:14 that talks about them being 50 cubits or 75 feet. And then in 9:16, the number of men killed at 75,000. That seems like that's way too many people to have been killed then. So in addition to those, there's also people who say that there's an issue in 2:5. Because it talks about Mordecai, if you look at 2:5, it says, "Now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, of whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away." So they say, if that happened, if that's when he was... Mordecai was carried away, then that would make him 120 years old by the time Esther is written. So they say that's an issue with it, as well as some historians say that there's contradictory data because Xerxes' wife's name was actually Amistris, not Vashti or Esther, like we see in here. And they also say that the fact that the very first verse of Esther, when it says, "Now in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces," they say that's an issue because there was actually only 20 provinces in Persia, and Esther uses that number twice in 1:1 and 8:9. So because of those issues, many claim that Esther is, at best, some form of historical fiction. So just quickly, let's look at those one at a time. So if you look at 1:1-5, you see, we'll look at starting in verse 3. "In the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all of his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and governors of the provinces were before him, while he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days. And when these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa, the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. So when you see that, that's not really that big a deal. So this, what probably happens is that can probably refer to just two banquets with 180 days in between, where his wealth is being displayed for 180 days, not actually a feast that's lasting for 180 actual days. So there's one feast and there's 180 days where he's kind of, guests are coming in rotation and he's like showing off his wealth, which history shows us that that's what Xerxes liked to do. He liked people to see how rich he is and all the great stuff he's got. So that's easily explained. But also there's a good chance that Esther here is identifying what they found out later. The reason he's got this feast going on is Esther is describing the time that Xerxes is making plans and preparations for that failed Greek expedition, which takes place right after this. That this is probably what the celebration has to do with around that event. So that's an easy historical problem to talk about or to fix. The year-long beauty preparation that you see in 212, that's something that, again, as time's gone on, they've actually discovered some Arab cultures that have the exact same custom where they prepare women for over a year with baths and covering them in good-smelling stuff over and over and over again for a year before they bring them to royalty, which is crazy. And Xerxes is the type of person who would probably do that same thing. So we see that in other cultures that they do that, so it's not out of the ordinary that that happens here also. The height of Haman's gallows that he constructs, that's only really an issue if you're like a Westerner thinking of what gallows are, and you're thinking of like one of those noose things from an old Western movie, and you're like 75 feet up in the air. That sounds ridiculous. Even so, it could be done, but you can even see that if you look at, so turn to 514 where that's at, and the footnotes help you understand what's meant there. So if you look in your footnotes, probably in most of your Bibles, so you look at 514, you get to that section, let a gallows, and there should be a footnote after that in most of your Bibles. You go down and look, and it says, or wooden beam. So what that means and what that's pointing to is the fact that what the Persian Empire actually did wasn't, they didn't hang people the way that you see in cowboy movies. That's not what it was. It was actually just a long pole, and hanging on it meant either being fastened to it, like Jesus hung on the cross, or it meant them being, even worse, impaled on it. And that's probably what it meant. That impalement was a regular Persian punishment. And so the fact that Haman wanted everyone to see Mordecai punished on a 75-foot gallows that everyone could see, that's not out of the question. That's something that can be constructed fairly easily, and it's not that big of a deal. It's just the fact that you don't see a 75-foot pole in other places in history, but that doesn't mean it wouldn't be here. So the only reason that people question it is because it seems out of the ordinary, which is not a good reason to question something. So the number of men killed in 916, that's kind of been answered more as time's gone on, because there's a lot of historians now that suggest that the population of the Persian Empire at the time of Xerxes was probably as high as 100 million people, and that the Jews of that time might have numbered between 2 and 3 million. So to think that between provinces that they put to death 75,000 people, that's really not as that big of a number as it might be if you're just thinking that this is a small little city. Like if 75,000 people in Greeley were put to death, that would be ridiculous. That's probably not going to happen. But that would be an inaccuracy, because that's more than half of the city. But in a place this big, that's not really that big a deal. The age of Mordecai, they're saying the age of Mordecai would be 120. I just reading that verse, so just go back to 2:5 again. I bet someone could answer this. But just looking at 2:5, just look at 2:5, you people who have studied grammar and stuff, and tell me why this doesn't indicate necessarily that Mordecai was the one who's carried out during Jeconiah, king of Judah's, when he takes him out. Look at 2:5 and what it says. 2:5 and 6. A Jew in Susa, the citadel. Oh, go ahead, Lauren.
Well, Brett gave me a weird look. Now I'm afraid that I'm wrong.
Go, do it.
So it says, there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjamite who had been carried away.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So yep. That guy, Shimei, is the one that got carried away.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's no, or son of Kish. There's no reason grammatically to think that it's talking about Mordecai, that he goes out on Jeconiah's exile. There's no reason to think it was him. It could have been Kish. It could have been his great-great-grandfather, which actually makes perfect sense. So, yeah, you guys can see that. You can just look in your English Bibles and see that that's not a big deal. So there's that issue, and then the 20 provinces. I didn't actually, when I was looking, I didn't actually see anyone make this argument other than this piece of paper that Brett gave me. So no one's actually making that argument maybe as much anymore, but apparently because Herodotus, one of the famous historians who talks about Persia, where we get a lot of our information, because he apparently said that there's 20 provinces in Persia during this time. Some people think that that's a contradiction, but most people seem comfortable just understanding that Esther is referring to a more intricate breakdown of the 20 provinces into 127 areas that can also be called provinces that are ruled by 127 governors who are the people present at the party in chapter 1. The fact that it says in other places that Xerxes' wife was named Amestris and not Esther, this is, again, not a big deal because, I mean, again, you guys could probably figure this out. Either this was another name for Vashti, that was possible. Certainly, it almost certainly wasn't another name for Esther, but it could have been a name for Vashti, or more probably, Xerxes has multiple wives because that's what kings did. And there's nothing, as you read about Xerxes, where you're like, well, he doesn't seem like the type of guy who would have more than one wife. He absolutely seems like that type of guy. So that's not a big deal either. So other issues that people have had include the casting of, like, well, that seems ridiculous, the casting of lots to determine the date of an important event a year in the future. But there's actually other historical events that have taken place in other cultures where they use dice to figure out when they want to do something. And again, that's the argument that just because we haven't seen it in other places means that it shouldn't be historical. That's not a good argument. Also, the idea of Mordecai holding such a high office, those Merashu documents I talked about show at least two other Jews in those documents who held prominent positions within Persian royalty. So that's not a big deal either. And in addition to that, we have biblical precedent, right? For other places where God does that exact type of thing, where he takes one of his people and he raises them to prominence within a foreign country. What places would those be? Raise your hand and one of the people will get it. What other places in the Bible do we see people from Israel raised to prominence in a foreign country? Name one.
Daniel.
Daniel?
Daniel was raised by the Babylonians, even though his heritage was as a Hebrew.
Yeah, yeah. Daniel, and he's raised to prominence. He becomes very prominent there. Does anyone have... I can think of one other really obvious one. You got it?
Joseph.
And Joseph. Good. Daniel and Joseph. Yeah. So there's biblical precedent for that type of thing happening. Did you say another one? You could use Moses, but more of like Prince of Egypt Disney movie Moses and less the Bible one, because he is there for a second, but when he comes back, he's hated. He's a hated Hebrew and murderer when he comes back. But yeah, technically he was raised as a prince of Egypt. And then, he is raised that way, so that's good. So with archaeology and discoveries about other ancient cultures, it is becoming less and less frequent, actually. This was encouraging to find out, to find people who will just outright say that Esther has absolutely no historical basis. Most of those arguments now use words like, well, I just think it's improbable. Not as many people saying impossible. In fact, The more historians, like I just said, discover about Xerxes, it seems to demonstrate that Esther is actually a very helpful resource in thinking more about who Xerxes was. Some other things that they've found in other documents about who he is, so these are from other things, a man with a quick and irrational temper. You definitely see that in 1:12 and 7:7 through 8. A man who indulges in a lavish lifestyle. You see that in chapter 1. He's famous for drinking feasts. That's the thing he's big on in the book of Esther. And one of the interesting things that they've discovered is that under Xerxes, Persia had what's described as a very efficient postal system, which actually plays a big role in Esther as stuff is communicated throughout the country. So that's very interesting to find out. So notice if you ever have to defend it, that the arguments against the historicity of the book of Esther, they're based primarily on the absence of confirming evidence from other historical sources and archaeology, not on the actual presence of contradictory evidence. That's a big distinction to make when people say that's not true. So, for example, when people say those numbers in there seem high, that amount of time seems long, 75 feet seems like too high for an execution pole. People use this as an argument for several books in the Bible, this type of argument that, well, it just doesn't seem like we see that in other places. But the problem is how many witnesses of something does it take to make something true? Actually, it takes zero witnesses to make something true. But one witness telling you about it is that doesn't make it not true just because there's only one witness. It has trouble in a court of law, but that doesn't make it untrue. In fact, if Esther wasn't a book of the Bible, people would just treat it as another ancient document that needs to be considered when they're trying to piece together the history of Persia. It's just because it's a biblical book that they're like, well, it doesn't say anything about that in other stuff we see. Again, that's not a good argument. So the book of Esther should be treated as a credible, trustworthy, historical narrative. There is no research that disproves anything that actually does happen in the book. And in fact, it does seem to affirm the basics of what we know about Xerxes and Persian culture at that time. Three reasons to believe it that you can just kind of get in your head that this is trustworthy is, number one, well, it's in the Bible. In addition to that, Jesus and the other New Testament writers just treated the whole Old Testament as trustworthy history. And even though Esther is one of a few books that isn't quoted in the New Testament, it was part of the accepted Old Testament canon at the time. And it's just quoted all the time as accepted history. There's no indication, number two, there's no indication that the book intends to do anything but provide reliable historical narrative. There's no indication that anyone in here is trying to tell a fiction of any, like Luke and Acts in the New Testament goes out of its way to include all kinds of unnecessary historical data that you wouldn't need to include if it's fiction. You don't need to include the family lineage of Mordecai. You don't need to talk about the 127 provinces, the exact date of Ahasuerus' reign. You don't need to say those things. And there's other historical facts in there that just show that I'm trying to tell you history. And then third, no other historical work has to go through the scrutiny of being doubted until another historical work can establish the exact same details. That's not how it works. They just do that for the Bible. There would be so much of world history that you learn in your world history classes that we wouldn't know if we just said that every single detail needs to be verified by at least two different ancient historians. There's some places where we only have one ancient historian telling us about it, and so we're just kind of taking his word for it. How much more so the Bible? So, it is historical narrative, and early rabbis, in fact, classified it as what they called Haggadah, H-A-G-G-A-D-A, which means that it is a narrative that serves the purpose of instructing one on how to live by examples. As such, it is extremely well-written historical narrative. Esther is, like Brett said in his opening, It is beautifully written. It is such a wonderful work among all of ancient historical works. It is written in such a way that it heightens the suspense of the story as it progresses, so that the tension of the reader just builds up continually, and then it resolves that tension in ways that you're not expecting. It's the type of story, it's honestly the type of story that would make for a great movie. A great movie. Unfortunately, some Hollywood people got together and made it into a horrible movie. Just terrible. But it would have made a great movie if they would have attempted that. One of the commentators I read said this, quote, "To say that the story of Esther is well told is an understatement. It is, by any standard, a brilliantly written story to be savored and even chuckled over," because there's some points of humor in it. "Now, the author concentrates more on events than on characters or motivations in order to quickly continue to build tension." Esther, as a book, so there's other places in the Bible that have stories that are kind of like this, but Esther is the longest such story that looks like this, that has such attention to detail, that takes the history and crafts it in such a way that it builds this suspense and then resolves it in these amazing ways. So all of that's the historical background. The purpose, and you can look in your for the big purpose clause here in your this thing. It says to display God's ongoing providential preservation of his chosen people in keeping with the unconditional covenant promises to Abraham and David, even while they're in exile, despite the serpent's continuing effort to annihilate the nation of Israel through Gentile persecution. It is to show how, even though the physical seed of Abraham has not been faithful to Yahweh, they are still protected by God from Gentile attack, even Jews who are living outside of the promised land being protected by God from Gentile attack. There's parallels to a few different places. We mentioned Joseph and Genesis and Daniel. There's also a real kind of connection to the book of Exodus as God saves his people from a foreign nation that seeks to completely destroy the Jewish people, with the major difference being that in Exodus, God saves his people through these amazing, miraculous acts where God shows his power, like through the plagues and through the judgment, the judgments on Egyptian gods, through the parting of the Red Sea, showing that he is God. But none of that type of stuff is in Esther. Instead, we see God save his people through what might be described as ordinary means. Or maybe by an unbelieving observer might describe them as kind of lucky coincidences or circumstances. So that's a purpose. Another purpose that you have to say is that it's to help to establish the background for the Jewish Feast of Purim. It gives the why that's a thing that they do. I want to in the purpose section, I also want to address the other interpretive challenge here that's listed in here, and that's the nature of Mordecai and Esther. The nature of Mordecai and Esther, or the understanding, were they actually faithful? Were they spiritual or unspiritual Jews? And if you turn to Nehemiah 1, so you can stay in Esther, but turn to Nehemiah 1 and notice something that was pointed out to you last week, where Nehemiah is. And you can see in verse 1 that Nehemiah is in Susa. And from 2:1, if you look down a chapter, you can see that this is during the time of the Persian king is now Artaxerxes. That's the son of Xerxes, the son of the king that's in Esther. And this is about 35-ish or so years after the events of Esther take place. You have the events of Nehemiah. So if you look at Nehemiah's prayer, so this is the same place as the book of Esther takes place, but a few decades later, this is Nehemiah's prayer. Starting in verse 4. "As soon as I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days, and I continued fasting and praying before the God of heaven. And I said, O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love him and keep his commandments, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant that I now pray before you day and night for the people of Israel, your servants, confessing the sins of the people of Israel, which we have sinned against you. Even I and my father's house have sinned. We have acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, the statutes, and the rules that you commanded your servant Moses. So you can see from that that this is the same place. And years later, Nehemiah clearly sees that the people, the Israelites, the Jewish people in Susa are unfaithful. He says, even in my father's house. So he's talking about Israel throughout history, but even all the way up to the present. So there is good reason to believe that the exiles in Susa, even in the time of Esther, are not faithful and they're not spiritual Jews. And some have used the fact that God isn't mentioned in the entire book of Esther as proof that Esther and Mordecai are just used in spite of their faithlessness. That is a common interpretation. And so that could be the case. I'm not going to say 100% that that's the case, or I don't even lean that way, but it could be the case. And if it was, it would not change the purpose of the book. In fact, there's actually a certain sense in which it makes it stronger. If the purpose is to show God protecting his people in spite of how they've acted and what they've done, the purpose remains no matter the character of Esther and Mordecai. However, I do think that the internal evidence of the book, based on the faithful actions that you see in Mordecai and Esther, as well as the fact that what we're going to talk about later, the absence of the name of God seems to be a literary tactic to emphasize the point that the author is trying to make. And that demonstrates that I think that the Mordecai and Esther are part of the faithful remnant there in Susa. So in the end, though, we have to say that we aren't ultimately sure if they were God-fearing, faithful people. But the point of the book is that God saves his people even without his name being mentioned at all. All right. Next is the outline. So if you look at the outline, I wrote on the little handout that I did, rather than making you, I was going to make you write it all out, and I realized I want that time for me, not for you to write. So if you look at the simple outline, is the 1-4 is the threat to the Jews, 5-10 is the triumph of the Jews. That's an easy way to outline the book. Then I have that second outline there, which is Vashti to Esther, Haman to Mordecai, calamity to good. And you can see that there's a much better version of that one on page 4 in your little handout, because it shows like that there's how it's organized that way. You can see that there's a royal edict and 2 feasts in each of those sections. And it's a really good way that shows the, just like I said earlier, the incredible way the person who wrote this book structured it. But also, I want you to see the chiastic structure of the book that I have in that other outline, which is, if I know we've talked about it before, and I'm sure other people have mentioned it, but the chiastic coming from the Greek letter chi, which looks like an X. I can't make an X with 2 hands. I don't know why I'm trying. Here we go. Like an X. And the idea is that the main point is in the middle. The main point is in the middle, and it kind of builds to the main point and goes away from the main point. And so you see that the way I put that there. There's the opening and background information, which parallels in chapter 1, which parallels the epilogue in chapter 10. There's the king's first decree in chapters 2 and 3, which parallels the king's second decree in chapters 8 and 9. There's the conflict between Haman and Mordecai in 4 and 5, which parallels Mordecai's victory over Haman in 6 and 7. And then there's that chapter 6, verse 1, which is the turning point of the whole book, where the king can't sleep. That's where everything starts to turn. So that's fun. There's some way like more complicated chiastic structures you can look at the Book of Esther, but this is the only one I was comfortable with putting on here. But you can go look those up on Google and stuff with a grain of salt. Some of them are way overreach, but some of them are pretty good. But all that to show, again, just how well organized this book is, how the author has chosen to lay out the events so that you'll see it the way that you see it. All right, next I want to do a somewhat quick review. So go back to the book of Esther. I just want to, because it's, you just have to do it with this book because it's a one single story. So I just want to do kind of a quick-ish review of the book. So the book starts out, like we said, that many Jews have not returned to Israel. So if you look at your map that you have, you probably want to look at that bigger, it's easier to see that bigger one at the bottom that's expanded. You can see Susa there over to the right. It's where the red arrow starts from because that's where Nehemiah's journey, his return from exile, starts from Susa. So that's... that's where things are. That's where things are going on. But you notice that Susa is where the exiles in Nehemiah returned from, and this is about 35 years before that happens. So these are some of these people that Esther and Mordecai save are those people who are leaving with Nehemiah eventually. So this book is about this Jewish community living in Susa, which is one of the chief cities, capital cities of the Persian Empire. The king throws two elaborate banquets, as we talked about, one banquet, and then most likely 180 days of celebration where he shows off all of his splendor and riches to people who are coming in and out, and he's letting them all see it. And then there's a seven-day feast to end it. And then if you look at, I mean, you can see, look at 1:6-9, you can, if you look at that description, it's just, he's just showing off how lavish, how elaborate everything is. I've got white cotton curtains and violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen, purple to silver rods and marble pillars and couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement. There's like all of this, it's just describing this splendor, and he's inviting everyone, come and look at how great all of my stuff is. And on the last day of this feast, he is drunk, as he often is, and he drunkenly demands for Vashti, the queen at the time, to come and show off her beauty to all of the people at his feast. And she refuses in a moment of, you know, early feminism, I guess. She refuses, and so he removes her as queen. His advisors come around and say, she has done an evil against you and an evil against the entire country. You need to remove her as queen and replace her with another. And then in chapter 2, his advisors come up to him and say, hey, you should bring all of the best women in the land before you and choose a replacement queen. And so, yeah, so it's not hard to be an advisor to the king, apparently. That's like oh yeah, I think I like that idea. Of course he's going to like that idea. And so in chapter two, his advisors tell him that. And so he holds kind of a beauty pageant type of thing. And it's in chapter two that we meet Mordecai, and we find out that he is the cousin of Esther, and he is raising her after her parents have died. We see in verse 7 that he is bringing up Hadassah. That's her Jewish name. That is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father or mother. So Mordecai is the cousin, not an uncle, is her cousin, and he's raising her. And at the end of chapter 2, Mordecai, we have something that kind of seems a little unrelated, but Mordecai, or Esther's chosen queen during that process, and at the end of chapter 2, Mordecai overhears a plot to murder the king, and he tells Esther, and it's investigated, and Mordecai gets credit for saving the king. If you look at 2:23, this is important. When the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows, so that probably means they were impaled, and it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. So that's a very important verse. Mordecai's discovered this plot, and he's seen it, and he gets credit, and it's written down in the books of the Chronicles, not the ones in our Bible, but the Chronicles of the Persian kings. So in chapter 3, And now I feel like I need to go out of order. I want to, really quick, chapter 3, we meet Haman. He's the kind of the villain of the story. And we want to see him like that. And in order to establish that, I want to talk about, in your major themes and characters section, I'm going to skip all the way back there, and I want to just talk about the characters for a second, because there's some stuff you need to know about Haman and Mordecai to make this, to kind of raise the tension here. So the major characters, Ahasuerus, the Xerxes, the self-centered, easily influenced, egomaniac king, he is not, and I want, how many of you have seen the movie One Night with the King? Okay, good. I don't need to discredit in front of you all. That movie portrays him as like kind of the romantic lead, and it's just, it ruins the story. It makes it so there's no danger for Esther to go before him. But the danger for Esther is only real if this guy's an unstable egomaniac, not a scorned lover. It's such a dumb movie. All right, sorry. And then there's Esther. Esther is portrayed as courageous. She's wise, the way she organizes these feasts at the end. She wisely humbles herself before the king in chapter 7. We see a lot of good stuff from Esther. We'll highlight that as we go through. And then there's Haman. He's this vindictive, proud man. It's actually hard to find a better example in the Bible of the truth that God opposes the proud than when you see what happens to Haman. And then there's Mordecai. So those are the four main characters. And Mordecai, he's dedicated to the Jewish people. And as you read the book, there is obviously some sort of deep-seated issue between Mordecai and Haman. And the only reason that Mordecai gives for not bowing before Haman is that, or that we're given for Mordecai not bowing before Haman in 2:4 is that he's a Jew. And so when you look at 2:5 and 6, now there is a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai. Mordecai, as a Jew, and that's the only reason that you're given for why he's not bowing down to Haman when Haman becomes popular, when Haman becomes important, not popular, he becomes important and is given this royal position. And we see that Haman not only hates Mordecai, but he also hates all of Mordecai's people. He hates all of the Jews. And the issue is actually a tribal feud between Mordecai's descendants, the descendants of Haman, that we don't know anything about in here. We actually have to go to 1 Samuel 15 to see that. So just quickly go over to 1 Samuel 15. Fairly popular story, but in 1 Samuel 15, 1 through 3, we see Samuel instructing Saul, the first king of Israel. He tells him this: "The Lord sent me to anoint you king over his people Israel. Now, therefore, listen to the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I have noted what Amalek," that's important, "did to Israel in opposing them on the way when they came up out of Egypt. Now go and strike Amalek and devote to destruction all that they have. Do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey." All right, so the Lord proclaims complete destruction for the Amalekites. And Saul, if you read through 1 Samuel 15, Saul defeats the Amalekites, and he almost utterly destroys them. He just comes so close, but we see in 7 and 9, he says, "And Saul defeated the Amalekites from Havilah as far as Shur, which is east of Egypt, and he took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive and devoted to destruction all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and of the oxen and the fattened calves and lambs." Anyway, so Haman is described as Haman the Agagite. He is descended from the Amalekites, from the king of the Amalekites, Agag. And Esther, so you read it, there's five times. So it's chapter in Esther chapter 3, verse 1, chapter 3, verse 10, chapter 8, verse 3, chapter 8, verse 5, chapter 9, verse 24. They all say Haman the Agagite. So it's important that you identify him that way, that that's who it is. So Agag does die, but it's not from Samuel. It's when Samuel does what Saul failed to do. In 15:32 through 33, Samuel said, "Bring here to me Agag, the king of the Amalekites." And Agag came to him cheerfully. Agag said, "Surely the bitterness of death is past." And Samuel said, "As your sword has made women childless, so shall your mother be childless among women." And Samuel hacked Agag to pieces before the Lord in Gilgal. So Agag meets a pretty violent death. But because of Saul's failure to obey God, so this is what's interesting. Saul did not wipe out the Amalekites. He did not. And apparently, relatives of Agag survive, and they survive to the time of Esther. So because of Saul's failure, way back here in 1 Samuel 15, to obey God's command, here hundreds of years later, 500-ish years later, the Jews in Susa are in danger. They're all in danger of dying because of what Saul failed to do way back in 1 Samuel 15. So Haman knows that Mordecai is a Jew and he hates Jews. And not just a Jew, but it says from, if you remember, he's a Benjamite, which is also the tribe that Saul is from. So there's a hatred there between Haman and Mordecai that runs deep. So that's important to know as we head back now into the story. So you need to know that going into the story. So at the end of chapter 2, Mordecai overhears this plot to murder the king. He tells Esther, and he gets credit for it. It's written down. And in chapter 3, we meet Haman the Agagite, and he becomes the most powerful man other than the king. And the decree is that everyone is supposed to kneel before him. And we're told that Mordecai refuses to do this because he is a Jew. And Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage in 3:2. So you see that he's refusing to bow down. And this makes Haman mad. It says it fills him with fury. Not just mad, filled with fury. And Haman finds out that Mordecai is Jewish and using a method that's actually similar to the accusers of Daniel, if you'll remember from the story in Daniel. Haman tells the king that there is this people. There is a people, O king, that observe different laws than your laws, and portrays them as the enemy, and he convinces the king to enact a decree that will allow Haman to annihilate the Jews on a certain date, a date that's chosen by the rolling of the dice or the Pur, the P-U-R. That's where Purim comes from. So the date is chosen to be 11 months from then, the 13th of the Jewish month Adar, which is actually I just looked this up. Purim this year is like in 2 weeks in March 16th and 17th. Falls on a different day each year. But anyway, so look at 3:13 through 15. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with instruction to destroy, to kill, to annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. A copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province by proclamation to all the peoples to be ready for that day. The couriers went out hurriedly by order of the king, and the decree was issued by in Susa, the citadel, and the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was overthrown into confusion. So what we have coming, according to this decree, is a Jewish Holocaust, an attempt to wipe out the Jewish people. And Esther and Mordecai discover the plot, and they respond appropriately. So look at 4:1 through 14. When Mordecai learned all that had been done, Mordecai tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city, and he cried out with a loud and bitter cry. He went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one was allowed to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. And in every province, wherever the king's command and his decrees reached, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and lamenting, and many of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. When Esther's young women and her eunuchs came and told her the queen was deeply distressed, she sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he might take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther called for Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs who had been appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what this was and why it was. Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the exact sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her and command her to go to the king to beg his favor and plead with him on behalf of her people. And Hathach went and told Esther what Mordecai had said. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and commanded him to go to Mordecai and say, "All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law: to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter so that he may live. But as for me, I have not been called to come into the king these 30 days." And they told Mordecai what Esther had said. And then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this." So going before the king without being summoned is a crime, and it can be penalized by death. So Esther is in real danger. And what happened to Vashti in chapter 1 should be in our minds as we read this. Esther plans to challenge an edict of the king that has been stamped into law. And so 4:14 through 16 is such a key text, and it's why some of you who still have kids coming someday are going to marry or going to name your daughter Esther because of this passage. Look at verse 15. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." So we see her resolve there to do what's right, even though it could very easily cost her her death. And so in chapter 5, then, we see Esther finds favor in the king's sight, and she requests that he and Haman attend a banquet that she would like to host. That's the request she makes. The staff is extended to her. She says, "Would that you and Haman come attend a banquet that I host." So if you're reading the book for the first time, that's a, what? That seems like she wimped out there or something. That's not what she was supposed to ask. But she's wise in what she is doing here. The king loves him some banquets. He's all about that. And she uses the occasion when she has the first banquet, and then the king asks, "All right, now what can I do for you?" And she says, "How about a second banquet?" And so tomorrow night, I want you and Haman to come back for another banquet. And so at the end of chapter 5, we see Haman leaving this first banquet, knowing he's got another one tomorrow night, and he's leaving, and it says he's leaving with a joyful heart. And then he sees Mordecai. He sees Mordecai, it says, at the king's gate, and he still has the audacity not to respect him, not to kneel and respect him. Everything that Haman has, and because of the disrespect from this one man, he goes home, and if you look at 5:11 through 13, he starts whining to his wife. even though he's got all of this stuff. So he says, Haman recounted to them, his wife and his friends, to them, the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, how he had advanced him above the officials and the servants of the king. And then Haman said, even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she prepared, and tomorrow also I am invited by her together with the king. Yet all this is worth nothing to me, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. So this is his complaint. He has all this stuff, and this is what he's whining about. And his wife has this idea. And his wife, Zeresh, and all his friends said to him, let a gallows 50 cubits high be made. 50 cubits high and be made. And in the morning, tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast. And this idea pleased Haman. And so he had the gallows made. So now we've built all of this suspense up through these first five chapters, and it's looking dire for Mordecai. Haman's coming the next morning to request, he already let me do a law to kill all the Jews. Surely he'll let me, put this one on a stake 75 feet in the air tomorrow. And so he's going to bed. That's the plan. But it just so happens on that night, the king could not sleep. Again, that's the turning point in this whole narrative. That night, the king can't sleep, and he asks for the book of memorable deeds and chronicles to be read to him, because that's what you do when you can't sleep. You read lists of events. But as they're being read, he hears and he remembers that he never honored Mordecai for saving his life. Just so happens to be on that same night where Haman's going to bed planning to kill him the next day. And then we get this wonderful section of irony in 6:4-10, where the king says, hey, who's in the court? And now Haman had just entered the court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's young man told him, Haman is there standing in the court. And the king said, let him come in. So Haman came in, and the king said to him, what should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? And Haman said to himself, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? And Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor, and let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. So he's like, that's what you should do. Then the king said to Haman, hurry, take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned. So Haman took the robes and the horse and dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. So you're supposed to see the irony there and see how God is orchestrating this amazing storytelling, because we see the work of God. We see what he's doing in this without even mentioning the name of God, but it's clearly God who's at work. And then you see in verse 12-13, you see this is what's going on. Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house mourning and with his head covered. And Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and his wife said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. So now we see the author demonstrating the work of God and the fear of God in these people. And in 6:14, we see that while he's hearing from his wife, his wife and his friends are telling him these things, he's whisked off to this. The eunuchs show up. He's whisked off to this second banquet. Esther has her second banquet where she tells the king now in 7:1-6. So he's there. He's pretty humiliated, and now Esther tells him everything, tells this of this awful plot, gets the king all angry about it. And then verse 6, and Esther said, a foe and an enemy, this wicked Haman. He is the one who has done this. And when Haman sees, and so it says that the king is furious. The king arose in his wrath from the wine drinking and went into the palace garden. And when Haman sees the king's wrath, he realizes that now his only hope is actually for Esther to plead for mercy on his behalf. So he falls on the couch that she is on and presumably upon her, begging for his life. And then the king comes in during that moment and assumes that he is assaulting the queen. And the king is filled with, it says now, the king is filled with fury. And in his mind, there is not a way that this guy can be killed fast enough. And then to Haman's disappointment, in verses 9 and 10 of chapter 7, you see, then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance to the king, said, hey, the gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose words saved the king, is standing at Haman's house. It's 50 cubits high. And the king said, hang him on that. And so they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. And then the wrath of the king abated. So, and then in chapters 8 through 10, we see the continuation as the king elevates Mordecai, and we see a counter decree made, which allows the Jews to kill all the people that were going to kill them. We see this major turning of events in verse 2 of chapter 8. And the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. And then if you look in 9, 1 through 3, now in the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's command and edict were about to be carried out, on the very day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain the mastery over them, the reverse occurred. And the Jews gained mastery over those who hated them. The Jews gathered in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm, and no one could stand against them, for the fear of them had fallen on all people. So that's a review, and then it's leading to the major theme of the book, which is preservation through providence. And you just really have to see the whole book kind of laid out there to understand the preservation through providence. Oh no, it's 7:23. All right, major themes, real quick. The Jews, they're a major theme. You can look in there. There's all kinds of verses about them. This is actually the first book in the Bible where we see the term Jew. Most likely it comes from the captives being from Judah. So this is the first book where we see the term Jews, and it's all over the place. We talked about major characters. Yes, I can skip some pages. But the thing I really want you to think about is one of the major themes of the book is that there is no mention of God's name in all of Esther. And I wanted to talk about that after we went through the whole book so you could see that the importance of this. Think about it. This is a book of the Bible. This is in God's Word, and God's name appears nowhere in it. This is actually one of the major interpretive challenges that some people have with it. But not only does it not mention God's name, but it doesn't mention Jerusalem. It doesn't mention the land of Palestine, the temple, the law. It doesn't talk about worship. It doesn't even mention prayer. It mentions fasting, but not prayer, even though the two are surely. By contrast, the king of Persia is mentioned 190 times in 167 verses. God's not mentioned once. In fact, Esther, obviously, if you remember that section from 4:14, Esther, the book of Esther, the author goes out of the way, it seems like, to not mention God's name. In fact, something I wanted to talk about but won't, the Apocrypha actually adds 107 verses to Esther to try and fix the problem of God's name not being in there. But the book is clearly organized in such a way that we're supposed to say that the way things unfold is not just coincidence. And I was going to ask you the question, why would the author do this? But I'm not going to now because there's no time. I'm so sorry. But just think of the encouragement that this is for us. that is for all of us, but especially the Jews at that time. God is at work. He's being faithful to his promises, even when they can't tell, even when we can't tell. He doesn't need to, it's such an encouragement, he doesn't need to part the Red Sea every time he decides to preserve his people. He's doing it in the mundane things. As you read through the book, you see that the author is skillfully wanting you to see this. He's wanting you to see a type of exodus where God is working through unmiraculous events. And it's so important because, like we said at the beginning, this is chronologically, there's only a little bit of Ezra, the book of Nehemiah, and Malachi that take place after this. And then there's hundreds of years of prophetic silence. And so in that time, the book of Esther is going to be such an encouragement as they don't see God miraculously doing anything, but they can think back to how he works through these mundane events. So that's the other two. Another theme is reversal of human plans. We kind of talked about that, so I feel like I covered it. And then God's sovereign rule over seemingly mundane events. And you just think of all of those things that happen at Vashti's defiance, the fact that there's a beauty pageant, Mordecai just happening to overhear a plot, the king's sleepless night, the existence of proud, self-absorbed leaders, the evil plans of evil men. God twists on them and uses them for his own good, for his own people. So I hope going home, think about this question. What are ways that you can be encouraged and strengthened and convicted by a book that doesn't mention God, but shows his power, shows him working through mundane things? I'll just tell you that it was just cool to see this week as I was with Paul in the hospital right after his heart attack, and he'd come around, and the cardiologist came in and said this exactly to him: "You are three times, you are very, very, very lucky." Paul was, they did CPR on him without a pulse for 12 minutes, and he said, "There just happened to be one of my cardiac nurses was in the audience. This is the one who did CPR on you." And so, in God's sovereignty, he wants Paul to go through this thing. And then also, all the mundane choices of this lady happening to be in this place and wanting to going to the basketball game that night, all of the things that took place for that to happen, these are the things that God is always, he's constantly doing. He's constantly working. And we can be so encouraged thinking back to any event in our life. There's a big time event, and thinking of all the little things that God has done to bring us to that point. And it is in that way that I think the book of Esther, and a few other ways that I can't read to you now, that I think the book of Esther is such an encouragement to us. So if you have any questions, since I didn't give you a chance to ask them, you can come and talk to me.